From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we continue our four-day series on the mind and the body. Today, when faced with terminal illness, can a patient's attitude change the prognosis? We hear from Dr. David Spiegel. In a groundbreaking study, he found that women with breast cancer lived longer if they were part of a support group. Also, we talk with psychiatrist Dr. Mark Epstein about how he combines the principles of psychotherapy and Buddhism to help his patients quiet their restless minds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Democratic Convention opened last night in Chicago. Delegates heard praise of their candidate Bill Clinton from two Republicans, Jim and Sarah Brady. Jim Brady, Ronald Reagan's former press secretary, was badly injured by gunfire during an attempt on Reagan's life. Brady and his wife thanked President Clinton for signing the Brady Bill into law, which is designed to keep felons from buying handguns. Tonight at the convention, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton is scheduled to speak to delegates. UPI's Bill Small reports on today's schedule.
This afternoon, Democrats will hear their party platform presented. There are no major issues of contention and no surprises expected, and it'll be officially adopted at this evening's session. That session will feature speeches by West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller and the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who has said his topics will include the welfare reform bill that President Clinton signed into law and that some Democrats, including Jackson, still strongly oppose. Tonight's session also includes the convention's keynote address by Indiana Governor Evan Bayh, speeches by Democratic candidates for the House and Senate, and speeches by First Wives Hillary Clinton and Tipper Gore. Bill Small at the Democratic Convention in Chicago.
The Republican presidential and vice presidential candidates are holding an economic summit in California today. It's part of an effort to rebut Democratic criticism that Bob Dole's economic tax cut plan is risky. The forum will be held in a produce distribution center in Santa Barbara. The United Nations Chief Weapons Inspector, Rolf Achaeus, is in Baghdad for meetings with Iraqi officials. NPR Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Achaeus arrived in Iraq following a series of standoffs earlier this month between UN weapons inspectors and Iraqi officials. The incidents occurred at sites the UN says are being used to hide banned weapons materials. 2 months ago, the Iraqi government signed an agreement with the UN to allow inspectors unconditional and unrestricted access to facilities believed to be part of Iraq's secret weapons programs. But this month, the UN said Iraq was in gross violation of that agreement. Achaeus, who has been very critical of the Iraqi government, alleged that Baghdad was shuttling banned weapons materials around the country by rail and truck in an attempt to elude inspectors. Iraq has failed to fully comply with the 1991 UN resolution to dismantle its biological, chemical, nuclear, and long-range missile programs. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
A hijacking in London has ended peacefully. British authorities report several Iraqi hijackers freed all 199 people aboard the Sudanese plane they had commandeered and surrendered to authorities. The hijackers claimed they had explosives. The plane, which left Sudan, stopped to refuel in Cyprus and then pressed on to Britain. The hijackers are now seeking asylum there. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 6 points at 5,699. The Nasdaq is up more than 5 points at 1,144. This is NPR. The Japanese government says the health threat posed by the E. coli bacterium in Japan appears to be subsiding. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The epidemic outbreak of the mysterious bacterium is settling down, says Japan's health minister. Naoto Kan told the cabinet that no new victims have been reported in the western city of Sakai, where the number of cases topped 6,000. Japan's school children have been hardest hit, with health officials suspecting school lunches as the source of the poisoning. But the government has been unable to precisely pinpoint the origin of the outbreak and has come in for harsh public criticism. The health scare has sparked calls for an overhaul of the nation's school lunch program. With school set to resume next week, the cabinet has agreed to step up inspection measures. While the outbreak appears to have passed its peak, local officials in cities like Sakai say it's still too early to feel relieved. In Tokyo, This is Julie McCarthy.
A published report says the federal government is asking TWA to help pay for the investigation into the crash of Flight 800. The New York Times reports the airline says the investigation is a government operation and TWA is not responsible for paying the bills. The paper adds that earlier this week, federal officials asked TWA for a voluntary payment of $5 million toward salvage and recovery. Authorities in Roxbury, Vermont, report five people were hurt this morning when Amtrak's Vermonter passenger train hit a logging truck at a crossing. Three of the five people were hospitalized. One of them was the truck driver. The six passenger cars on the train, which was going to New York and then to Washington, D.C., jumped the tracks and then came to a stop. Observers say it now looks something like an accordion. The Roxbury accident is about 15 miles south of Montpelier, Vermont's capital. People living near the site brought chairs to allow uninjured passengers to sit down. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we continue our series of interviews on the body and the mind. Dr. David Spiegel is a psychiatrist who works with people who have life-threatening illnesses. He says he's found that the best way to face the threat of serious illness is to look it right in the eye, to face the worst, rather than simply to hope for the best. He's a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine, where he's been studying the connection between the body and the mind. He conducted a landmark study on the value of support groups for women with metastasized breast cancer. I spoke with him after the publication of his book, Living Beyond Limits, about facing life-threatening illness. He's critical of how both modern medicine and alternative medicine deal with illness.
I think the problem with modern medicine is what I like to think of as mindless materialism. The model in modern medicine is that the body is a machine like a car, and that if something goes wrong, you just replace the part. And we're so focused on high-tech intervention and on what I think of as the myth of cure. We really have, rather than a health care system, a disease cure system in which the whole focus of medical intervention is thought to be curing illness. When the fact is that most Americans live with and die of chronic illnesses like heart disease, cancer, and stroke, and what people need from their doctors is caring, is learning how to live with these serious illnesses. So while certainly we should go for a cure whenever it's possible, I think we've lost sight of the oldest tradition of medicine, which is to cure rarely, to relieve suffering often, and to comfort always. And I think we've got it backwards, and we need to get back on the old track of what medicine is all about.
You have your criticisms of alternative medicine, too.
Yes, indeed. Now, the other extreme is the alternative approach, which I call disembodied spiritualism. And the idea there is that if you fix a problem in your head, it will automatically and magically get fixed in your body. So if you just visualize white cells killing cancer cells, boom, somehow that will help happen in your body. And ironically, that movement has the same myth of cure, the idea that somehow you can fix it if you just wish it away. And there's just no evidence that that works. And I think it lays a terrible burden of guilt on people who, when their disease progresses, as many diseases do, they then are left with a feeling guilty that they didn't visualize well enough and cure themselves of a disease. And I think that's a pernicious myth as well.
Do you think of yourself as working someplace in between modern medicine and alternative medicine?
No, I don't think so, actually. I'm a physician, I'm a psychiatrist, and I have the highest regard for the tradition of medicine. And what I would like to do is redefine medicine. I think this is not alternative medicine, it's not complementary medicine, it's just good medicine to help a person cope with an illness and not just focus on the technical narrow interventions.
Now, you've said that you started your support group study expecting to prove that there wasn't a connection between survival and positive thinking. Why did you expect that you would find no connection, especially as a psychiatrist? Why did you expect that connection wouldn't exist?
Well, being a psychiatrist teaches you modesty, and you learn that there are tough problems that you come up against. And I, knowing what I know about cancer and its progression, I thought that we could help people live better with it, that we could help reduce their anxiety and depression and even help them control pain. But I was not prepared for the evidence that we found that enhancing social support and coping with disease might have an effect on the rate of progression. I'm interested in the problem, but the effect we found was just far stronger than anything I would have guessed at the beginning.
Share with us what the results were.
Well, we had 86 women who were assigned by what we call a randomization, in which you allow the toss of a coin or a computer to select who gets a year of weekly support group interventions, and who gets just routine, standard, excellent medical oncology care. And we found after the initial year that the women who got the intervention, that was 50 of the 86, were less anxious and depressed and had half the pain. But what was much more surprising was that by the end of 4 years, all of the control group had died and a third of the treatment sample were still alive. And the average survival time for the intervention sample was 18 months longer than that in the control group.
Can you interpret the results? Why do you think it is so that women with breast cancer who were in a support group lived longer than their counterparts who didn't have that support group?
Well, there, you know, it seems almost mystical, but there are a number of studies that show that social integration is a powerful variable in mortality. This was reviewed in Science several years ago by James House. And in general, the relative risk of dying if you're socially isolated is elevated as much as if you had high serum cholesterol or smoked. It's a powerful relationship, and yet we ignore it, pay little attention to it. I think there are four possible mechanisms that could account for what we observed with breast cancer patients. The first is what I like to think of as the grandmother effect. Perhaps people who are less anxious and depressed and are coping with their disease better do all the things your grandmother told you to do. Eat well, sleep well, and get plenty of exercise. So it may be sort of the body maintenance things that these people do better. The second possibility is that they make better use of their health care, that they get diagnostic tests when they need them, that they adhere better to treatment regimens, and get more vigorous treatment. They may elicit more vigorous treatment. You know, the doctor sees a woman who has lots to live for, has a book she wants to write or a project she wants to do, and figures, okay, we'll go that extra mile and give the next round of chemotherapy. So that's a second possibility. The third involves the endocrine system. Stress causes our body to release hormones like cortisol and prolactin in higher amounts. And these hormones have been shown to stimulate the growth of tumor cells, particularly breast cancer. That's why we often use estrogen receptor blockers like tamoxifen and Megase to slow the progression of cancer. So it is possible that if you handle stress better and if social support acts like a stress buffer, you may be reducing your own body's tendency to stimulate the growth of the tumor that's in it. And the fourth possible mechanism involves the immune system. We now know that the nervous system and the immune system talk to each other, that white blood cells that attack cancer cells respond to neurotransmitters, the chemicals that one nerve secretes to stimulate another nerve to action. We also know that cytokines, which are secreted by the white blood cells involved in the immune system, affect the central nervous system, and that stress can reduce the functioning of certain parts of the immune system, can increase vulnerabilities to infection, and that social support can buffer that block. So it's possible that in some way being a part of the group helped these women's immune systems function better.
I want to make it clear that you're not saying that positive thinking alone is going to help you a lot. You say denial and overly optimistic attitudes are not helpful.
Terry, that's absolutely right. I'm a proponent of realistic thinking, not positive thinking. In fact, the women in our group call that alternative point of view the prison of positive thinking. And an example is some woman started to cry and her husband said, "Stop crying, you'll make the cancer spread." Who needs that? What we try to do is help people realistically face what's ahead of them. And that means face the disease and its treatment, the fact that it may well shorten their lives, and live as well as you can in the face of that knowledge. So that means at times you won't be positive at all. You'll be sad, you'll be upset, you'll be frightened. But the interesting thing that I've seen time and again over the 15 years we've run these groups is that shortly after we're there crying about how terrifying this illness is and what it means, we'll be laughing about something else. And what you do is you free people to feel negative feelings and to feel positive feelings, to see the joy as well as the tragedy in life.
How does the support group experience compare to the typical conversations the women in the support group were able to have with their own families?
Well, you know, it depends a lot on how open the families are. But what we found is that there is a kind of intensity about the support groups that many women say is quite different from what they can usually do with their families. They know it's a place where they're going to deal with their worst fears, and it becomes a time and a place to, as one woman put it, feel better about feeling bad. They're with other people who know what they're going through. And so at times it's easier for them to share their fear, their sadness, their frustration, their anger with other women who are in the same boat than it is with family who have their own problems to deal with it as well.
I saw the Bill Moyers program about your support group, and one of the moments that I found really, really moving was when the daughter of one of the women in the group came and spoke with you, and she was weeping, the daughter, and she said that, you know, her mother was the person who had the most faith in her. She'd had a lot of failures, but her mother always believed that she'd do fine, and she felt that when she lost her mother, she'd be losing her greatest friend and her greatest ally.
Yeah.
But she didn't feel like she could talk like this to her mother because she thought that her mother would fall to pieces if she heard this, and that they just both weep uncontrollably, and it would be miserable. What advice did you give her?
Well, no, I've never lost anybody in terminal weeping, and I advised her very strongly to have that talk with her mother. Now, this was an unusual situation, and that fortunately her mother watched the Bill Moyers show, too, so she got, got the message. But one of the touching things in that meeting, actually, the best advice came from the mother of a woman who was dying, and she said to her daughter, "You're my best friend." They both started to cry, and the daughter said, I knew that, but it means so much more that you've told me that. And I think there are a lot of things that we take for granted, that of course they know that, and we don't bother telling people, and they're the most important things in life. And the proximity of death, if it's handled right, can get you to say those things that you want to be sure the person knows before they die. Now, that's a kind of a stark and difficult thing, but that's what I indeed encouraged this young woman to do, to talk with her mother. There's nothing terrible about crying together. It can be a wonderful thing.
What's your job as the psychiatrist and leader of the support groups?
My job is to keep it on track, to keep the focus on the feelings. I kind of scan the room looking for signs of emotion, of sadness, of fear, of anger, and encouraging people to talk about that. I cultivate a look of bored inattentiveness when they're talking about, treatment swapping and, you know, what's the latest new far-out treatment to try for cancer, and try to keep the focus on dealing with the hard things. This group is a place to deal with the worst fears and anxieties and share some great joys that people have. But I want to keep it serious and important and focused on dealing with feelings and using it as an occasion where people can feel better about themselves because they can genuinely help one another. For example, one woman who's a newspaper editor was saying that, you know, I'm worried that my husband will have to lose interest in me because I'm not the sharp, witty, hard-edged, tough reporter that he married. I'm getting sort of soft and fuzzy. And another woman in the group said, you know, I like you soft and fuzzy. I think this is a new you and you ought to develop it more. And it was a whole different angle on what she felt she was losing. And that kind of interaction is the kind of thing I really encourage.
My guest is Dr. David Spiegel, author of Living Beyond Limits. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. David Spiegel. He's a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine, where he's been studying the connection between the body and the mind. You give advice to families who are trying to talk about life-threatening illness. And some of the advice that you give is to state your feelings, not conclusions, to listen and restate what you heard, and to admit when you've had enough, and to choose the right time and place to talk. Why is it important to state your feelings and not conclusions? What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the common problems that we all have in negotiating differences that life forces on us, little ones as well as big ones, is as a way of protecting ourselves, we reach premature conclusions about what other people are doing. So if somebody slights you in some way, you know, and you say to them, you know, you're a jerk or you're always saying stupid things, what can the other person say except fight back? You know, because if they accept it, then they're humiliated by it. If instead you say to them, you really made me feel small or silly when you said that, you're admitting they had an effect on you, and you're not reaching a conclusion about what their motivation was or why they were trying to do it. So it's a way of getting the message across, saying, ouch, it hurt, without making the other person so defensive that they're just going to get angry and tell you you're wrong. So it's a style of communication that has been called non-defensive directness that I think is a way of helping people deal with tough issues in a way that's more constructive.
Why is it important to admit when you've had enough?
Well, I think admitting your emotional limits is very important, particularly in the context of dealing with problems like life-threatening illness. Many people fear that if they get into a discussion about this, they're going to open Pandora's box. The feelings will flow. They'll cry or get angry and never stop. And that doesn't happen, but it's what people fear. And it is true that talking about it can be taxing, not only from the point of view of the person with the disease, but the person who loves them.
You make the point in your book that hope for a cure is just one kind of hope. What are the other kinds of hope that you think, for instance, a support group can offer?
Support groups can offer hope that if you can't be cured, that you can live a very interesting, productive, worthwhile life during the time that you're coping with the progression of the illness. So it's a kind of realistic hope. It's not the false hope that life will be the way it was before this all happened, which is what everybody understandably wants, but many cannot have. But it's a different kind of hope. They can watch somebody who, we had one woman in the group who'd been a frustrated poet all of her life, and before she died, she had written two small, very fine books of poetry. I quote some of her poems in Living Beyond Limits. And so they can see that life isn't over, that it may not go on, you may not die when you're 95 in your sleep, but there's a lot of interesting, worthwhile things that you can do, and you know it's true because you see other people in the same boat as yours who are doing it. So I think it provides a kind of realistic hope in which people kind of redefine the horizons of their life, what the dimensions of it are, but then say, okay, given that, what can I do that I want to do with my life now?
Do you talk about this a lot with the people in the group, the responsibility of the dying to the living?
You bet. That's a major issue. And some lovely things have come of it. I just attended a memorial service for a woman who died several weeks ago. And she sat down and wrote a letter to her 4-year-old that was read at the service, in which she talked about how she had been reluctant to play the piano because she didn't do it perfectly, and she set very high standards to herself. But one day she did, and she turned around and noticed that her 4-year-old was dancing to the music. And she said, "You gave me a gift because I realized I was playing just fine if you could enjoy it that much." And that's a legacy for her daughter. And this is something where she was giving a gift to her daughter that is of tremendous importance.
I don't know exactly what my question is here, but it has to do with acceptance versus anger. When something happens to you very sudden, you know, like suddenly finding out about an illness, your life has changed, and suddenly there's this big line, this big before and after line, mm-hmm. and nothing after will ever be quite the same.
That's right.
And so you could get really angry about it, or you could try to work yourself into this state of acceptance about it, hoping that eventually you will accept it. And you know, I sometimes can't tell which is better. I mean, it seems like anger is really justified, although maybe pointless. And you don't, you know, maybe acceptance too soon is either kidding yourself or giving in when maybe it's better to fight.
Well, I think you're right, Terry. You know, in a sense, you don't control your feelings. You control what you do about them. You control what you think and how you cope. But your feelings happen to you. And I think there's something sometimes phony or unduly constraining about saying, well, you know, I'm supposed to be past this stage now, so I won't be angry. I'll do
right, there's
this.
The 4 stages of how one copes, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And people aren't like that. And mm-hmm. so what I'm saying is just give yourself room to feel what you feel.
Right.
Now, just because you're angry doesn't mean you go out and do all kinds of crazy things about it. But if you feel that way, feel it. That's okay. And what I find is that people shift from state to state. So for a while, they'll be mad as hell, and then they'll somehow find that they're just not as angry about it as they used to be. But then maybe 2 months later, they will be again, and that's okay. It's a matter of giving yourself permission to feel whatever it is you feel about it.
You've been giving so much thought in the past few years to the relationship between the mind and the body in coping and in healing. Why are so many mainstream doctors so far behind on this, so willing to even entertain the fact that the mind might have something to do with the healing process or with maintaining life a little bit longer?
Well, Terry, you know, medicine has struggled to be a science, and There is always a danger in, you know, if you look through the history of medicine, there have been an awful lot of stupid treatments that have been done because people thought it was right rather than tested to see whether it was right. So I can understand why doctors want to be skeptical and critical and make sure that there's good proof. At the same time, I think we all have trouble getting the possibility that an intangible intervention can have tangible results. And yet, that's the way our bodies work. You know, what do PET scans that show brain function show us, really? That when you choose to do a certain task, the oxygen metabolism and glucose metabolism in certain parts of your brain changes. So what we're learning is that there is an active interaction between what we think and feel and how our brains and endocrine and nervous systems work. And I think our science is beginning to get sophisticated enough that we can understand in traditional Western scientific terms this interaction.
You write that serious illness is not a good thing, but good things can come out of it. I hate hearing that kind of statement from somebody who's a real Pollyanna, but you're not. Mm-hmm. So tell me what you mean when you say good things can come of it.
Well, it can. What I mean is, I don't think anybody wishes it on themselves. I think it's a terrible mistake to tell people that they needed their illness and that's why they got it. That's nonsense. But what I am saying is this, that if the illness becomes an occasion for you to take stock of your life and get rid of some things that have been, in retrospect, mistakes, and commit yourself to new things, to tell people you care about how much you care about them, to do things you've been putting off but need doing, it doesn't mean that the illness is good, but it means you can make something good of it. If you can use your experience of coping with cancer to help somebody else get through it better, that is a genuinely good thing that you're doing for someone else that came out of something that's a tragedy. But you know what? A lot of human life is like that. You know, we have to live with tragedy. It's a part of life. And the best things we do in the human condition are making something decent out of those tragedies.
Dr. David Spiegel, recorded in 1993 after the publication of his book Living Beyond Limits, about facing life-threatening illness. He's now conducting a 10-year follow-up study to his landmark study of the impact of support groups on women with breast cancer. He's also conducting a similar study on support groups and people with AIDS. Both studies will be completed in 1999. We'll hear more from Dr. Spiegel in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the medical uses of hypnosis. We continue our conversation with Dr. David Spiegel. His father did pioneering work in the field. Also, psychiatrist Mark Epstein discusses combining principles of psychotherapy and Buddhism to quiet the restless mind. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Dr. David Spiegel. Dr. Spiegel is the author of the book Living Beyond Limits, about facing terminal illness. He's a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University, where he studies the mind-body connection. He's also studied the medical use of hypnosis. Dr. Spiegel co-wrote a book on the subject called Trance and Treatment with his father, Dr. Herbert Spiegel, a psychiatrist at Columbia University. Dr. David Spiegel told me about his father's pioneering research into the medical use of hypnosis.
He began using it in World War II. He was trained to use it. He was a battalion surgeon in combat in North Africa. And he was being trained as a psychoanalyst, but you couldn't carry couches with you on the battlefield. So he had to do something more applied and more rapid. And he discovered that that soldiers that had what we would now call acute stress disorder, but was then, a traumatic neurosis, could be helped within, and returned to the front within days rather than being evacuated out never to return with techniques like hypnosis, in which they would relive the stress and gain a new perspective on what they had been through. So when he returned to the United States from the war, he began to use it to treat a variety of problems, to help people stop smoking, to control pain, to deal with anxiety, and found that it became an increasing and is now a pretty much a total part of his psychiatric practice.
I'm sure he was considered pretty kooky, especially at first.
Well, it's interesting, actually. He was worried that he was going to ruin his reputation as an analyst. And Frieda Fromm Reichman, a famous and wonderful psychoanalyst, bawled him out and said, "What are you so worried about your reputation for?" and insisted that he give a seminar on it at the Psychoanalytic Institute that he was training at. So at first it was seen as a rather peripheral thing, but I'm glad to say that as his reputation grew, the interest in the field as a whole did. And it's still not entirely accepted as a mainstream phenomenon, but I'm convinced that it is. And the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association certify it as a mainstream legitimate medical technique, and it's taught at the best medical schools in the country.
Now, what do we mean by hypnosis? You know, the pop culture cliche of hypnosis is that some guy makes you watch look at a watch that's swinging back and forth, and then you're in a trance, and then he says, "When I snap my fingers, you will think you are a chicken." And he snaps his fingers, and then you start squawking.
Well, it doesn't work with digital watches, you know.
Right.
That's the problem. All that hypnosis really is a state of focused, attentive concentration with a suspension of peripheral awareness. And you don't need a dangling watch. In fact, if you're hypnotizable, you do it all the time. Have you ever had the experience of being in a good movie and getting so caught up in the movie that you forgot you're watching a movie, you know, and then when the thing's over, you kind of have a little jarring experience of reorienting? Has that ever happened to you?
Sure, yeah.
Well, that's a hypnotic-like state. It's the suspension of disbelief. You're not critically judging it. You're just experiencing it. So anytime we narrow the focus of attention, it's sort of like looking through a telephoto lens instead of a wide-angle lens. You see something very clearly, but ignore the context, and you don't judge it. That's a hypnotic-like state. You put certain things out of your conscious awareness that could be in your conscious awareness, and you focus very intently on one or two things. That's a hypnotic state.
Now, how do you use that? How do you channel that to control pain?
Well, right now, Terry, if you're sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
Okay. You have sensations from your back and your legs touching the chair, I presume. Mm-hmm. But until I mentioned it, hopefully you were not aware of them. You were more interested in what I was saying. In the same way, we're constantly directing our attention toward certain things and away from other things. We do it instinctively. We have to, or otherwise we'd be overwhelmed by perceptual input. Now, if you can do it with normal sensations, like touching the chair, you can do it with abnormal sensations, like pain. Most people with chronic pain, for example, find that it's worse evenings and weekends than it is during the day. Why? Because they're absorbed during the day doing their work or schooling or whatever it is. And it's when you have time to sit back and ponder it that the pain seems to get worse. So what you can learn with this focusing of attention in hypnosis is to say, I'm going to focus on a sense of floating or lightness or warmth or coolness or on sensations in some other part of my body. And you simply pay less attention to the pain signals.
Now, how do you direct somebody to focus their attention away from their pain onto something else?
Well, the crucial thing is you don't fight the pain. You know, if you do that, you'll make it worse instead of better. Instead, you focus on some absorbing image. I often ask people to imagine that they're floating in a bath or a lake, or in California, hot tubs are popular, or just floating in space, and absorb yourself in that image. See what it feels like to be floating in a hot tub. So you're not simply remembering it, you're trying to re-experience it. And as you do that, you'll notice that the tension in your body tends to decrease, and you can start to concentrate on what it would feel like to be floating in a hot tub. And these gradually become sensations that can become a kind of filter between you and the pain. So you still know the pain is there, but you experience it through this filter of warmth or coolness or lightness.
Does tension intensify pain?
Absolutely. Muscle tension increases pain. You can make your muscles hurt right now by just squeezing them tight enough until they hurt. And yet what most people do when they have pain is they splint the area around the pain. They pull on it, and they literally will produce more pain. So if you can simply stop fighting it by tensing up your muscles, you can reduce literally the amount of pain that you experience.
My guest is Dr. David Spiegel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. David Spiegel. He's a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine, where he's been studying the connection between the body and the mind. He and his father wrote a book on the medical use of hypnosis. Now, if hypnosis is a temporary, almost trance-like state in which you're concentrating on one thing and not another, when you kind of get up out of your chair and stop focusing on the warm bath or whatever, will the effects of that stay with you?
It varies. For some people, it does, because you've interrupted this cycle. One thing that's known about pharmacologic treatment of pain as well is that if you break the cycle early, you do much better. The cycle of pain, because it seems to set up a kind of feedback in the nervous system where the signal's coming in, the brain is disinhibiting it, more signal's coming in, and it kind of builds, you get more anxious and unhappy and tense, and on it goes.
Right, because even with painkillers now, I think the new way of thinking is you should take a painkiller before the pain intensifies to its ultimate limit.
That's exactly right. Get it early. And
yeah.
The same is true for psychological techniques like hypnosis. So in some way, you interrupt the cycle. But I think the other thing that may not be clear to the listeners is, you know, a hypnotic state is not something that you have to attain after a half an hour and that you stay in and you're out of it and then you return to ordinary life. It's something you can shift into in a matter of seconds. It's just a state of focused concentration. So many people who are good at this learn to shift in and out of this hypnotic-like state all the time to reinforce their control and then go on about what they're doing. So although most people would say that the pain control is best when they're in the hypnotic state, many find that they get a fair amount of relief for some time, minutes to hours afterwards, and they can very quickly reestablish that control.
Now, you even advise your patients who, for instance, are going for chemotherapy treatments to leave their bodies behind, just to kind of get out of their body. So why don't I ask you to explain what you tell them?
Well, it's a typical Californian trick,
where,
as people have out-of-body experiences. But one of the things that happens with chemotherapy is you get a kind of conditioned nausea and vomiting, where you know that the chemotherapy is likely to make you nauseated. So just thinking about going to the hospital or the smell of the chemicals in the hospital tends to provoke another attack of nausea and vomiting. And what we teach people to do is to say, I've got to deliver my body here, but I don't particularly want to be here. So you just have them focus on going somewhere else. One woman, I used to have her picture going on a trip, but she got a little bored with that because she likes to keep herself busy. So she imagined that she had purchased a castle on the Rhine, and while she was getting her chemotherapy, she was redecorating it room by room, and she got completely absorbed in that, and it was a way of detaching herself from the normal reaction, the feedback of input and output that tends to lead to tremendous discomfort.
Now, you tell a story in your book about how when you came out of med school, I think it was like early in your career as a doctor, you had a patient who was having a terrible asthma attack. The medicine was not helping her, so you decided to use some self-hypnosis. Tell us what happened.
I was a medical student then at Children's Hospital, and they informed me that my next patient was down the hall. It was an asthmatic and what's called status asthmaticus, which meant that she hadn't responded to medication. And I just followed the sound of the wheezing down the hall. And I walk in the room, and there is this 15-year-old redhead bolt upright in bed, wheezing, knuckles white, mother wringing her hands. And I didn't know what else to do, so I had just taken a hypnosis course in medical school and said, would you like to learn an exercise to help your breathing? And she nodded. And so then I realized that I better figure out what to say to her because I'd never treated an asthmatic before with hypnosis. So I hypnotized her and said something very sophisticated. Each breath you take will be a little deeper and a little easier. And within 5 minutes, she's lying back in bed. Her knuckles aren't white. The wheezing is better. And the nurse ran out and filed a complaint with the nursing supervisor who accused me of hypnotizing a minor without parental consent, although her mother was in the room, and there is no such law in Massachusetts. So we went through several days of argument about whether this was dangerous or not. And finally, the intern had a great idea. She said, let's let the patient decide. And the patient said, I like this. Well, this young woman had been hospitalized every month for the last 3 months. She had one subsequent hospitalization but hasn't been hospitalized since and learned self-hypnosis and for a while was learning to be a respiratory therapist to help other people deal with it. So I figured that anything that could help the patient that tangibly and violate Massachusetts law had to be worth looking into.
How do you use self-hypnosis yourself?
I use it a lot for anxiety control when I'm preparing a big talk or something. I will put myself into a state of self-hypnosis, use an imaginary screen, get my body floating and comfortable, and outline the major points that I want to cover in the talk. I've also used it for pain control. I had a recurrent dislocating shoulder, and I had surgery on it, and it was 3-hour surgery. I decided to let the anesthesiologist take care of me during it, but afterwards, I used self-hypnosis for pain control and didn't use any medication. And after a day or two, I walked over and read my medical record. I wasn't supposed to do that, but I did since I was a doctor. And the surgeon wrote, patient using little pain medication, we mustn't have cut many nerves.
Oh, they always take credit for it.
Right, exactly.
So you didn't tell the doctors who were attending you that you were using self-hypnosis?
No, I was afraid they'd put me on antipsychotics.
So how much... How kooky are you considered now for practicing hypnosis?
Well, you probably have to ask someone else, but I think I'm glad to say that I think it's becoming a much more widely accepted technique and being seen as a serious, scientifically studiable phenomenon. I teach a course on it at Stanford Medical School, and there are courses at Harvard and University of Pennsylvania and many fine medical schools. And we're also learning something more about the science of it. We've done some studies looking at brain electrical activity, showing that when you hypnotize someone and give them the analgesia instruction, their brains actually respond less to the same signals, that you can show a reduction in the amplitude of the electrical activity over the part of the brain that is responding to these signals. So we're beginning to see that there is a brain connection here, and that when somebody tells you they're feeling less pain, they're actually feeling less pain. Their brain is damping down their response to the signal.
Dr. David Spiegel, recorded in 1993, after the publication of his book about facing terminal illness, Living Beyond Limits. He's a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University, where he studies the mind-body connection. We all have to cope with mental anguish. In the Western world, people often turn to psychotherapy for help in understanding the source of their pain. In the East, meditation and related spiritual practices have helped people quiet the restless mind. Dr. Mark Epstein is a psychiatrist who combines elements of psychotherapy and Buddhist teaching in his private practice, and he's written a book explaining why. It's called Thoughts Without a Thinker. Epstein began studying meditation before entering medical school. At Harvard, he worked with Dr. Herbert Benson, who was a pioneer in studying stress reduction. Psychotherapy deals with neurosis. I asked Dr. Epstein if there's any equivalent concept in Buddhist thinking.
There is not an identical concept as neurosis in Buddhist thinking. Buddhist psychology has always been very phenomenological in its orientation. It was derived from people sitting for many years watching the quality of their own minds. And so what you find in Buddhist psychology is an identification of all the different mental states that can arise in a person's mind and how those mental states can be shaped by the practice of awareness. So there are concepts of greed or hatred or attachment, aversion, and ignorance. in Buddhism, but not notions of neurosis per se.
Now, a lot of Freudian analysis traces problems back to feelings of sexual inadequacy or some kind of sexual-related problem, or to problems relating to how your mother or your father treated you. This strikes me as a kind of un-Buddhist way of looking at life.
I'm not sure that it's particularly un-Buddhist. What Buddhism teaches is that all mental anguish is ultimately derived from some kind of craving. The word they use translates as either thirst or craving, some kind of desire or longing for things to be different. And much of sexuality, much remembered experience of one's childhood is colored by those feelings that Buddhism describes as central. So I think that Freud and all the psychoanalysts who followed him were attacking the same problem, almost as if from the outside, peeling away the skins of the onion. And what they saw first was sexuality, and Freud's great discovery, one of his great discoveries, was that children are sexual. Sexuality is everywhere. And when they peeled that away, then what they found was anger. The early primitive feelings of children with their mothers wanting more. And so there was a great interest in anger. And then they peeled anger away, and what they found was insecurity, fear and insecurity, that we're all driven by the sense that we're not good enough, and that's the psychology of narcissism. And as they peeled those layers away, they got closer and closer to what Buddhism has always been teaching.
You write in your new book that you've seen too many people go round and round in therapy, and occasionally they get insight, but the insight brings them no relief.
Yes.
And I think a lot of our listeners will know what you mean.
Yes.
When you say that. But so where does Buddhism come into play there?
Well, I also write, and I've also seen people who have gone round and round in meditation and have found no relief. So I want to make clear that I'm not setting one up as the cure for the other.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have found is that most people, at least in our culture, can make good use of both, and that each has something different to offer, so that what we find in Buddhism is an actual method, an actual technique of shaping the mind, of working directly in yourself, on your own mind, and that can often make the difference for someone who has done good work in therapy, discovered where they're stuck, but still can't get past it. With the mental power that comes from working in meditation, it's possible really to go beyond where therapy leaves you off.
Memory is a very important part of analysis. I mean, part of what you're doing is trying to remember your past and make sense of it and understand how the past is shaping your present.
Yes.
What's the role of memory in meditation and in the larger Buddhist way of thinking? And when I say Buddhist, I should say, which school of Buddhism are we talking about that you have studied the most?
Well, there are three main schools of Buddhism, at least that are represented in this country. The first coming from Southeast Asia, from Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and some parts of India that teach a practice called Vipassana, which means insight meditation. Then there's Zen Buddhism, which comes primarily from Japan, China, Korea, and then Tibetan Buddhism. And I've had the most experience with the first, but some experience with the latter two. All of them are very similar in that the core meditation technique is a practice known as bare attention, B-A-R-E, like naked attention, simple, non-judgmental awareness of whatever is happening in the mind and body at any given moment. And the word, going to your second question about memory, the word in the Buddhist language for the kind of practice that is the core technique of all of Buddhism, the word translates as remembering. Because what you have to do is remember in every moment to bring your awareness back to whatever's happening right then. And that sounds simple, but turns out to be incredibly difficult. So in Buddhism, there's much more of a premium, much more importance is put on the here and now, that memories, as we think of them, memories of what went wrong in the past, when they come up, there to be experienced as they're happening right now, experienced, felt completely, attended to, and then let go of.
My guest is Dr. Mark Epstein, author of the book Thoughts Without a Thinker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with psychiatrist Mark Epstein, author of Thoughts Without a Thinker, Psychotherapy from a Buddhist Perspective. In your practice, you're trying to combine certain insights you've gotten from studying Buddhism with the work that you do as a therapist. Now, we're in an era where a pharmacological approach seems to really be displacing the talk therapy model. It seems, you know, more and more that people are on antidepressants and other related drugs, and sometimes that's combined with talk therapy, sometimes it's not. And I wonder if you use a lot of antidepressants and other prescription drugs in your practice.
Well, people ask this question a lot. I think you're absolutely right. We are definitely in that era. I feel that one of the two or three things that that I learned in all of my medical school and psychiatric training had to do with the place of these drugs in people's mental suffering. There is definitely a place for them. I do use them when I feel that they're indicated. They are sometimes very helpful. They are by no means a panacea, but when they work, it feels like a godsend. So I do not keep people from using them out of some kind of Puritan or Buddhist ethic that they should be able to cure themselves with the power of their own minds. A lot of people in Buddhist circles or in Western circles of people who embrace spirituality do have a prejudice, which is a kind of backlash against the pharmacological approach. A lot of people do have a prejudice against using the medicine, and for those people, I often counsel, you know, where it's safe, which medicines work, and so on. But I do not think that the value of the medicines outweighs the value of a good talking therapy. And I think what we're actually seeing is a kind of backlash against the pharmacological takeover of psychotherapy, which is happening a lot in league with the managed care companies. And if it's not happening already, I think we'll see soon a resurgence of talk therapy, perhaps influenced by Buddhism.
Now, you once went with other people from Harvard to study monks who were able to raise their body temperature.
Right.
Did they think that you were crazy coming there with all these fine tools of measurement?
Yeah, I think that they did, especially because one of the things that we had to do was to insert a rectal probe while they were meditating, and it was only because the Dalai Lama himself had asked these monks to please cooperate with us that I think that they were able to. And they just looked at us with this kind of ironical, bemused look while we were fussing all around them. and they were very cooperative.
What did these monks do?
These monks were practicing an advanced form of Tibetan yoga called Tummo Yoga, which translates as heat yoga, in which they raise their inner temperatures so that, for instance, they can sit outside naked in freezing weather with wet sheets draped around their shoulders and dry them with their own body temperature. And these were practices that were documented almost 100 years ago by the French explorer Alexandra David Neal, who wrote a number of rather fantastic books about her journeys in Tibet. And we were unsure whether these practices actually existed or whether she had made them up when we first began the research. And we approached the Dalai Lama, asked him if, in fact, these practices were real, if they were still being done. He said, yes, they were. He could tell us some people who were doing them. And he thought it might be helpful for Western science to see the, you know, one example of what these practices could do and of what the mind was capable of.
The Dalai Lama wrote the introduction to your book, Thoughts Without a Thinker. And he writes, "The purpose of life is to be happy. As a Buddhist, I have found that one's own mental attitude is the most influential factor in working toward that goal." Do you agree with him when he says the purpose of life is to be happy?
That's actually a very radical statement and also a very Buddhist statement. And all of my Western background rebels against the simplicity of that statement.
Yes, and maybe your parents told you, as mine did and probably everybody's did, that no one can be happy all the time. No one ever said you were put here to be happy.
That's the great thing about Buddhism. People always think that it's a pessimistic religion. Mm-hmm. You know, the first noble truth is that life is suffering. Buddhism has a very bad name for its pessimism, and yet it's relentlessly optimistic. You know, the purpose of life is to be happy. We all want happiness. We're all trying desperately through, usually in the wrong ways, to make ourselves happy by accumulating material things or by feeling that we have to pump up ourselves somehow. And I think the Dalai Lama, I have come to agree with him in spite of myself, is that if we can find the right path, that it's not only is it the purpose of life, but it's also a possibility.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Dr. Mark Epstein is the author of Thoughts Without a Thinker. Our interview was recorded earlier this summer. We'll continue our series on the body and the mind tomorrow. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Roberta Shurock, and Phyllis Myers, with Barbara Bogave, research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language, publishers of book, audio, and CD-ROM foreign language instruction programs. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series on the mind and the body. Dr. Fred Cheftel discusses headaches, and Dr. Barry Gordon discusses memory. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.